Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here they come again. That gaggle of Washington politicos and pundits who keep assailing Joe Biden's package of FDR-ish proposals that, at long last, would begin lifting up America's infrastructure and working class. Too big, screech these small thinkers and servants of the plutocratic order. Too costly and, well, too democratic. You would expect such adamant minginess from anti-everything Republicans, but these are Democrats. Well, sort of. They're Chicken Little Democrats, a subset whose members fastidiously call themselves middle-of-the-road moderates. Actually, though, you can almost always find them hugging the right-hand lane, clucking that the party of the people is scaring the people with policies that, get this, directly benefit the people. This was their excuse when one of their own political adherents, Terry McAuliffe, recently lost the Virginia gubernatorial election. It's their fault, cried the mods, claiming that poor Terry lost because progressives refused conservative demands to slash key Democratic reforms from Biden's infrastructure bill. They claimed that cutting progressive proposals from the bill would have made it more acceptable to Virginians. As one political columnist wailed, had congressional Democrats given voters a reason to turn out, that would well have made the difference. But wait, it's the job of the candidate to motivate voters. McAuliffe, a lackluster peer of the business-as-usual Washington power structure, ran a lousy campaign, basically assailing his Republican opponent for being a clone of Donald Trump. True, but besides not being Trump, what was Terry offering to grassroots families to excite them about voting for him? This is Jim Hightower saying, and guess what would have been a winning issue for him? That big progressive version of Biden's infrastructure bill. It happens to be very popular among the voters McAuliffe needed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I think the funniest story I've seen today, maybe you know the name Joel Olstein. He's a televangelist. To me, another charlatan. One of those guys who talks about the Bible and talks about, you know, love thy neighbor and all that stuff. But when there's a hurricane and a flood, slams the doors of his megachurch so nobody comes in. Because he's got to stay away from those people. Understand, his church was, I think it was the Summit in Houston. It was a basketball arena where the Houston Rockets used to play. Yeah, that's the church. A giant arena. And a couple years ago, I guess it was, 7 years ago now. 2014, his church was ripped off. They claimed about $600,000 in cash and checks were stolen from a safe in Olstein's Lakewood Church there in Houston. And nobody knew what happened to it. They offered a bunch of money for it. Nobody came around with it. It was just gone. Well, evidently a plumber was fixing a wobbly toilet, removed some tiles from the wall, and lo and behold, bags of checks and money totaling $600,000. They found it. And evidently the church didn't give him the $25,000 reward for finding it. So he got stiffed, not surprising. But I'm curious, how'd that money get in the wall and for whose benefit? You got to wonder. Look, I've got no faith in these charlatans. I wouldn't be surprised if the folks at the top were the ones shoveling it in the wall. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our favorite reporter, Sarah Burris. She's a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, their website. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, happy Thursday.
So what do you make of the $600,000 in the wall behind the commode?
Karma. Ahoy, Captain Karma, permission to come aboard. First of all, let's talk about how great the plumber is, right? Plumber needs to get his $25,000 because that's just what's right and just about this situation. Also, I can't help but marvel at the fact that it was a plumber that found it. It just makes me think of Watergate and and all of the funneled money there. But I mean, I wonder what was on the other side of that wall, because if it's his office, that's going to be
difficult. A little shady.
But I mean, honestly, that guy's teeth are way too white. Like, I just don't trust somebody who's got teeth that white. That means he's not drinking coffee or red wine, and that's just not right.
Yeah, I mean, but $600,000 in a weekend. Stop and do the numbers of what the kind of money that they bring in for a year. And guess what? They don't pay any taxes on it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the question is, you know, did he think that hiding the money in the wall meant that he didn't have to pay taxes on it? Because it's, you know, in the church?
No, I wonder about the insurance. I wonder about the insurance. I mean, I'm sure it's all insured. How much did an insurance company lay out and all of that? It's going to be interesting to see where this goes and very excited to see where it's going to go. But hey, speaking of shady, good segue into David K. Johnston's book. David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalist, new book out. I think you've gotten it. The Big Cheat, how Donald Trump fleeced America and enriched himself and his family. He's saying in his book that Trump and the Trump Organization pocketed a cool $1.7 billion in their time in the Oval Office. I got to tell you, I think that sounds a little low to me.
It kind of does sound a little bit low, but one of the things that I can't help but notice is that if you go through all of the money that Trump lost, particularly during the pandemic, which was really rough on him, I don't think he broke even. Even with the 1.7, I don't think that results in all of his golf clubs and his condos and everything that emptied out in Manhattan, because the Tiffany's lease came up in Trump Tower, and a lot of bad things happened to him in 2020.
Yeah, it makes you go back to that, the statement that he didn't really want to win, that the whole "I'm going to run for president" was just a leverage to get more money out of The Apprentice, and when he ran, then it became, I'm going to try and bilk this for when I can. And then the ego trip that comes with it. But, honestly, I would have been happy had he lost and had his leverage and gone on to do The Apprentice for four more years. I'd have been completely happy with that. We wouldn't have gotten fleeced. He'd have been happy. It'd have been a win-win.
I don't know if he could have lasted four more years. They could have done a contract for that long, but I think they would have ended up buying him out because the ratings on that show were dropping big time.
Here's the thing,
who knows?
In the same vein, the book points out that, Trump sold his Beverly Hills mansion for twice of what it was to some Indonesian media baron. And you go, is nobody paying attention to this?
It was not just that, too. It was an Indonesian media baron that he was promising that he was going to do some big deal with. And it was like a deal that he's been promising for a long, long time. And right up until, I guess this August, I think that was the first time that the dude was like, oh yeah, they're in a holding stage right now over at the Trump Organization. We're going to let them, figure stuff out first, and then we're going to bring them in. He's Indonesian. I don't know why I'm talking like he's an idiot dude from Texas. but yeah, basically this amazing, massive $7 billion development that's supposed to be like the new Hollywood of Asia. That's what Trump was investing in when he was going to build there. And that's not happening now.
Oh, I'm sad. But, David K. Johnston goes through this and in the book details, how him being president kind of screwed up the business and the grift that he was used to. Because, look, you listen to when he was running for office, there were a lot of people coming out saying, he screwed me over this way and, mm-hmm. bankrupted me this way. It's kind of hard to do that when you're sitting in the Oval Office.
Yeah, so there were all these people that basically he would just go through investor after investor after investor, and he would just keep screwing them up. But there were always more investors. Well, whenever he became the president, he really couldn't do the same sort of con that way, particularly when you've got all of these requirements that a president has to file disclosures and, everything else. And if he's not going to divest himself from his business and put everything in a blind trust like he said he was going to do, then he's basically just like digging himself, you know, a big financial hole and shoving it in the bathroom wall, or, you know, it's just not... It's not going to work out for you, man.
But doesn't that play into the, you know, the Trump supporters? You know, he had a great life and he's lost a bunch of money. He loves the country. Doesn't it play into that kind of jingoistic rhetoric that we hear?
Well, what's interesting about it is that, and David K. Johnson talks about this a little bit in the book, is it's really just consistent with all of his business. This has been who he is since the very beginning. And we've, you know, early on in his campaign, folks were talking about how if he had just taken the $10 million that his dad gave him and just invested it and left it there, then he would be richer now than he was if, you know, he built this business around it, because he's lost that much money. He screwed up that many businesses. So, you know, he's just he's a crappy businessman who kept being a crappy businessman and then, you know, threw his money in the toilet.
Right into failing upwards and becoming president and putting us in the mess we're in now. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Sarah Burris. Sarah is a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. You want to check out the work that she does. The question that I have, Sarah, is how the kids doing? I saw you've written a couple of pieces on Jared and Ivanka on how they've been doing. I guess they bought some nice real estate from this Chilean billionaire. Got a good deal on it, too.
Yeah, they got some serious bank, and it turns out they've made a whole bunch of money working while they were in the White House. They were not taking a salary, I guess. I don't know if Jared was, but Ivanka wasn't, and they apparently made hundreds of millions of dollars while they were working in the White House. And now all of those relationships, particularly the ones in the Middle East, Jared is basically turning those into his own pet investment firm that he's running out of Miami. And, you know, he's using all of the money from the Saudis and, you know, all the other countries that he could convince to invest in. So
now all this stuff is out here. And look, you know, I'll be honest. I know my Trump supporter friends aren't going to care. He's just a good businessman and taking, you know, the opportunity when it arises, he's a go-getter. I get that. But, you know, some of this stuff has got to be illegal. And at some point, doesn't someone have to look into this and hold them accountable? I mean, don't they have to sign some kind of disclosures? Don't they have to sign affidavits that they're not going to line their pockets and do what they've done? Isn't there something somewhere?
One of the things I found interesting that I didn't know before, or I guess I didn't read about it, I don't even know how many people knew, but when they decided that they were going to file their financial disclosure forms, you fill those out under perjury, under penalty of perjury. So if you're not telling the truth on those things, then it is like you are in serious legal trouble. And they instead renegotiated it so they would file based on some kind of assumption, some sort of assumed reality instead.
I had my fingers crossed.
Yeah, and it just seems like that whole thing seems super shady to me. Like, how do we even know that this was really the truth? Ivanka's money, particularly in 2020, you can even look through her financial disclosures, how much money she was making from the Washington Hotel, and it was something like $7 million. And then in 2020, it fell down to $1.5 million. And the investment, the actual money that she valued, her share of the hotel at dropped from something like, you know, 20 million, or I think it's something like 25 million to 500 million, because that's not the world's biggest, you know, gap there. And it dropped to something like 200,000 to 500,000. It's like, man, I mean, we knew that he lost a lot of money, but it's just like, holy crap. That is, you are the worst businessman in the face of the planet if you lost that much money.
Yeah.
I mean, geez.
Yeah, well, look what he did to the country. You know, he did run up trillion-dollar deficits each year, and that was without the pandemic. So, you know, no surprise. And this is the thing that gets me, and I hear this from my conservative friends all the time. Well, he was such a good president. He made the economy better. And I'm going, yeah, with $1 trillion in excess spending. Look, you know, I can throw a good party, too, with $1 trillion.
Yeah, that's the thing, is if you have the Congress and the Senate to give it to you, then you can pass some pretty amazing legislation. And the fact that he somehow couldn't manage to pass the transportation bill under under his presidency, when he had infrastructure week after infrastructure week, they had the House, they had the Senate, and really the only thing that they passed was that tax bill.
That's it.
The Republican tax bill. That's the only thing that they got out of them in 2 years when they had that much power. I mean, at least Biden got the stimulus package and the infrastructure package, which still isn't even big as we would like for it to be. But, you know, I mean, that's just a complete and utter failure as a president and I think as a party.
No, it's crazy. And, you know, you look at the fact that the reports that have come out is Trump did everything he could possibly do to stop the infrastructure bill from going through. And you go,
yeah.
You know, had you done that from day one, we wouldn't have gotten the cute picture of him driving the truck all angry looking. Not that he could drive the truck, but we'd have gotten something done. And then there he was trying to hold it up.
Yeah, he screwed it up because it looked like it actually could have happened in 2019. But because the Democrats were investigating him, he basically said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. And Pelosi at the time was like, I knew he was going to try and find a way out of this. Well, now when Biden was in office and trying to negotiate everything, Trump was talking to all of his friends in the Senate saying, you know, you guys can't support this. You can't support this. Well, then finally, when that didn't work, the week of the vote, when Republicans were going to vote in Congress on the bill, Trump is working the phone, calling every single member of Congress that he knows and threatening them and saying, you cannot vote for this. You absolutely cannot vote for this. We're talking about communities that need this money. They need these bridges. They need new they need to replace all the lead pipes, the crumbling sewer systems, all of these things that are super important. And Trump is so angry that the country is getting it under somebody else, that he basically just wants to kill the whole thing and destroy the country. Like, who the hell are you, dude?
He's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
This is what you expect from him. And I'm not surprised. I am not surprised because look, you know, it's that mentality. If I can't have it, if I can't do it, nobody can. And let everything burn down. So I'm not even in the least bit surprised by what we see here.
Oh, it's so sad. And it's, you know, stuff like this is coming out too at the time of year when everybody's supposed to be doing everything nice for each other and you're filled with warmth and love and family. And you read this stuff and you're just like, God, what a sleaze bag. Like, how did I function for 4 years rushing to write every single little thing that this dude was dealing with?
Yeah, no, it's crazy, crazy stuff. But fortunately, down the road, hopefully we don't see him again. But Sarah, I appreciate the time. As always, great work. Keep it up. Look forward to your next articles. Thanks so much.
Yeah, have a good weekend, everybody.
Good stuff. Our good friend Sarah Burris. Make sure you check out her work over at rawstory.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Quick break, right back after this. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1859. That was the day John Brown was hanged in Charlestown, Virginia, in what is now West Virginia. He had been sentenced to death on charges of treason, murder, and insurrection for his role in the raid on the United States Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry. Brown and 21 abolitionists intended to seize the arsenal there, then build a free settlement in the Appalachian Mountains. From there, abolitionists and free people of color would wage a guerrilla war against the slave labor system throughout the South. Convicted on November 2nd, Brown resisted plans for rescue and prepared to die a martyr. And on this day, John Brown wrote his last statement. I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done. He was marched out of the Jefferson County Jail through a crowd of onlookers that included Stonewall Jackson and John Wilkes Booth to the gallows where he was hanged. While many abolitionists distanced themselves from his actions, they defended him and memorialized him after his death. Frederick Douglass remarked many years later, "His zeal in the cause of my race was far greater than mine. It was as the burning sun to my taper light." Mine was bounded by time. His stretched away to the boundless shores of eternity. I could live for the slave, but he could die for him.
Oh, John Brown's body lies molding in the grave. I weep the sons of bondage whom he ventured out to save. And though he lost his life in his struggle to free the slaves, his truth is marching on.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
John Brown's body lies molding in the grave.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. You got a thought, question, comment, something on your mind? We'd love to hear it. Got an email during the break, and thank you, Jim Walker, for sending that. He points out that, you know, the Greyhound workers went on strike on March 2nd of 1990. He said the company hired scabs, permanent replacements. The labor board ruled after 3.5 years on the strike. 1993, that the strike was a legal strike, but the company had the right to keep the scab workers. But the union could come back to work as needed and maintain their seniority as they were reinstated. He says the last members returned to work in mid-1995. The union signed up all the scabs as union members immediately following the labor board's decision. Today, 2001, one of the scabs is now the national union president, ATU Local 1700. And look, I remember the Greyhound strike. And that was one of those things that, yeah, that's what they went through. And good on him for coming around. I'll be honest with you. Once you have that stink on you, I don't see how anybody comes around to supporting you. But, you know, hey, good on them for getting past it. But I remember that strike. You know, I was in Cleveland at the time. And, you know, the reality, it was a violent, violent strike. There was lots of stuff going on. And this is where I come back to, it doesn't have to be this way. You know, when these companies feel they have the upper hand and they can do this, it puts people's backs against the wall. Nobody wants a strike. Nobody. I've been on strike in my life, wanted no part of it. But sometimes you have to do what you have to do to maintain your wages, hours, conditions, to get some of the wealth that your labor creates. In this country, we have the right to strike. This idea that you could permanently replace somebody is ridiculous. And our law says that, and this is the part that gets me, the original intent of the law was not to allow the permanent replacement of people. It wasn't. And I come back to, it was the culture. You know, 1990 was a different era than it is now. 1960 was even different then. You know, I listened to the stories of my grandparents' generation and people who fought the labor battles. Remember, work in this country was really, really difficult and low paying. Before workers had the right to organize, before it was a right, we still had people organizing and trying and fighting, even though, you know, there was no law behind them. And they still were fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, but not as effectively. The skilled trades did well, but, you know, the truck drivers, the factory workers, those were horrible jobs until they were union jobs. And I think back to my grandparents. My grandparents got married. My grandfather got out of the military, you know, during World War II. Got married, got his first job shoveling coal off the back of a coal truck, making 17 cents an hour, and then up to the minimum wage of 25 cents an hour. And then the union came in and made their lives better. They went from being, you know, basically living in their car to leading a middle-class existence on one income. That is very difficult to do today. And it's all because of the union. It's all because of the wages that were paid and earned. You know, this wasn't something that they were gifted. There was no benevolent corporation. They didn't do that. But you also didn't have a CEO making 300 times what the average worker was making. You didn't have gazillion-dollar CEO pay. You didn't have, you know, $200 million golden parachutes. You had a society that wouldn't tolerate it. And this is where I keep coming back to. We need to learn our labor history, which is why one of the things we do here on this program is air our labor history in too. Because it tells us what happened in the past. What built what we take for granted? What built our ability to have a weekend, to get paid after 40 hours? And when I started working, 8 hours was the day. And you got paid overtime after 8 hours. There was none of this wait till 40 nonsense. And slowly but surely, the wealth class of this country, the corporate class of this country, has destroyed what the greatest generation built. People fought, bled, and died for the 8-hour day. The mantra, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what you will, is what built the 8-hour day. People died. And, you know, my friends in Chicago know this as well as anyone with the Haymarket affair. People died for what we take for granted. And we don't know about that because we don't teach it in schools. Very few schools teach labor history. When I was in school, what I learned about labor's history was about the Molly Maguires and that they were criminals. You didn't realize that the ancient order of Hibernians was an actual group who were fighting to make the mines safer, to make wages better, to make living conditions better for people in the community. But no, it's they're criminals. Why? Because they wanted a fair share of what their labor created. Now understand, from the end of World War II until the middle 70s, and you can look this up, how we love to believe that our economy is this great meritocracy. That, you know, you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. We've all heard that, right? From the end of World War II to the middle 70s, that was true. Productivity and wage gains walked hand in hand. The more productive you were, the better pay you got. And there's a great graph out there that shows it. You walked hand in hand. Sometime middle 70s, neoliberalism, the conservative movement takes hold, this whole corporate mentality, the Powell memo in 71 starts the conservative movement's push towards saving free enterprise, which means, you know, a heavy media blitz against those dreaded unions, which means setting up the Heritage Foundation to come up with bad ideas for model legislation, the American Legislative Exchange Council, to push those bad ideas into Congress and all over politically, all with the aims of making work less prosperous, slowing the ability of workers to bargain for better wages, hours, conditions. And they've been very successful. To the point to where there is a generation now that knows nothing about labor unions. And, you know, Sean Richmond, you know, said a moment ago, a reporter went out to cover a story, and, you know, they call themselves the Teamsters. You know, when I was a kid, when you saw those horses on someone's jacket, you knew there was someone who made a decent living. I tell the story often. I went into a local high school one time, and I had my Teamsters jacket on. A kid goes, "Yeah, I see you work with horses." And I joked, "Yeah, I'm a jockey." Thought it was funny, but I missed an opportunity. I could have educated that kid. Because when I saw that as a kid, I thought that's a way out of the projects. That's a way to a better life. That's a way to prosperity and opportunity. And what the right has masterfully done, and what the corporate class has masterfully done, is they've spun a tale of unions putting companies out of business, which is ludicrous, of unions being greedy and only care about themselves and being self-centered. And of every time there's a strike, it's the employee's fault. Because unions don't do a very good job of tooting their horn. They don't do a very good job of communication. They don't do a good job of PR. They need to do a much better job of telling their stories, which is reality, union job, better life. That's simple. End of story. When I was a kid, I saw the neighbor. He got a job at the Ford plant, a UAW job. Immediately, within the first week, you saw their lives got better. They had food at the end of the month. In my neighborhood, that was a luxury. A couple of weeks, you saw the kids had secondhand bikes. For school, the kids had better clothes. They bought a secondhand car. They eventually moved up and out. Their lives got better because the work that they did was rewarded. Now, I'm a work guy. I don't believe in handouts. I believe in people have to go to work. There's an opportunity in this moment. And if, you know, Joe Manchin is against the idea of, you know, we're not going to give out any welfare, bring forward a works plan. I believe, and I've believed this from the beginning, there should be no handouts. There should be no welfare programs. None of that. There should be jobs programs. And those jobs should pay a living wage. If the private sector can't or won't, more likely won't create enough jobs, the public sector has to. And if we did that, if we truly had full employment, you would see wages find a much higher position. Because, hey, people have to have jobs. And people are going to demand that those jobs pay and pay a decent wage. So we're in this competing world right now. We're in this competing world of corporate interests saying, no, no, we want the slow wage growth. We want to crush wage growth. We want to move the responsibility of health care and retirement security onto the back of the workers, not onto the government. No, we can't have that because that would give workers an opportunity to move around. No, no, we still want them tied to this job. But we're going to shift the costs onto their back. You know, there was a point where healthcare was paid for by the employer. It's part of your compensation package. Now they've trained us to believe all of us should be paying for our healthcare. And it's almost, I've talked to people who believe it's like an abomination if someone doesn't. You know, they look at union members and go, you get healthcare and you don't have to pay for it? You go, no, I pay a lot for it. It just doesn't come out of my pocket. It comes out of my compensation. But it's almost like, you know, oh my gosh, you shouldn't have that. And I'm going, when did we become that country? When did we become the country that says, you know, if you have something, you shouldn't have it because I don't? You know, I remember a country where if you had something and I wanted, I go, hey, how do I get that? How do we both have that? How do we both do better together? Because understand, there's a force in this country right now. Our corporate class is pushing this idea of taking us back to the days of you know, 100 years ago, where if you were desperate and hungry enough to work for poverty wages in desperate conditions, hey, man, that was your right. It was your liberty. And they exploited that. And workers were exploitable and expendable. And we're moving back to that. Every time I talk to people, oh, I've got this, you know, gig job. You know, I'm doing, you know, this dash or that lift or this thing, or, you know, I'm my own boss, taking on all the risks, all the responsibilities, and not getting all of the profit. While simultaneously destroying employment, the kind of employment that provides Social Security when you get older, Medicare when you get older. Pays into unemployment insurance, so if you lose your job, pays into workers' compensation in the event that you get injured. That's the thing these gig folks don't bother to tell you. You're taking all the risks. And what's frustrating to me is, you know, they're doing a great job selling it. They really are. Slick PR campaigns. I see some of these ads. Oh my gosh, this young girl's flashing cash around in large wads. You go, holy wow, she's making bank. Yet the people I know doing those jobs, it's more of a tax cheat than it is making money. We're heading into scary times because we're on the edge of two kind of ideologies. The hooray for me and the heck with everybody else kind of mentality that you get from the right, and one on the left that's trying to compete with how do we make people's lives better and pull some of the people on the right to help. And I hate using that right-left frame because it's really, in the world that we live in, it's the rich and the poor. But sadly, the rich own our political class. It used to be, and I used to joke about this all the time, I used to say, you know, the sad reality is the rich have all the money, but we've out-procreated them. There are more of us. We can vote. we can vote them out of office. We can bring people in who are going to do the right things. And in fact, conservatives used to be concerned about that, which is why they didn't go as far as they've gone. because eventually the people get enraged and they throw bums out. But you look at the rage that we see today, and this is where, you know, it's bizarre to me. The rage today is someone else has something that I don't have. How do we take that from them? The rage today is in some weird spots. And look, I understand the anger. I grew up in communities there where factories left and families struggled. And you had a government that didn't pay attention. And look, Joe Biden doesn't get everything right. But in talking about remaking our manufacturing base, in talking about remaking our economy the way it was when my grandparents' generation ruled the roost, that's the right direction. Returning reward to work is never a bad idea. It is always a good policy. And that's what the infrastructure bill is. The fact that they were able to keep prevailing wage in it is a huge win. And the Build Back Better plan for me is an investment. Is it enough? Is it targeted in the right, in some, all the right places? No. But it's targeted in a lot of good places. And while there are some like Joe Manchin who say, no, we should be doing these individually, knowing that this would take forever. And that's the point, to slow down what we the people want. I've yet to find someone when you start talking about just issue. You know, should children be able to have access to pre-K? The majority of people say, absolutely, we want that. We need kids to be ready for school. We need to do better in education. Should we help families with childcare? Yeah, because families are struggling. We are now in a world where one income doesn't cut it anymore. Wages have been so depressed that one income doesn't do it. Should we help families put food on the table? Even conservatives say yes. Because if you remember, the program that helps the poor, the earned income tax credit, was actually signed into law by Ronald Reagan. It was an Uncle Milty plan. So conservatives used to believe this stuff. What we see now is the people running the Republican Party, they're not conservatives. They're radicals. They're corporatists. There are people who want incredibly dangerous changes to move us towards more fascistic type policies. And that is dangerous. To me, that's dangerous. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Bob Nay is going to be back to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Back after that. Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 2001. That was the day that energy trading giant Enron filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It was the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history up to that time. At its peak, the Houston-based Enron was the seventh largest company in the country. A combination of mismanagement and all-out greed sank Enron. The company used numerous accounting tricks and loopholes to hide billions of dollars of debt from its shareholders. In August of 2000, shares of the company were worth $90.75. But by November 30th, 2001, they had plummeted to just 26 cents. After filing bankruptcy, thousands of Enron employees were left to go down with the ship. Many employees and retirees had thousands of dollars worth of Enron stock. Employees were told the company would recover. They were encouraged not to sell off their stock and even to buy more. While at the same time, top executives were dumping their stock holdings. When the company went under, the employees' retirement accounts were wiped out. Some who had already retired had to re-enter the workforce. The following January, a New York Times report shared the stories of some of the 4,000 employees laid off in the immediate aftermath of the bankruptcy. One was told he lost his job by voicemail. Another was told he had 30 minutes to clear out his desk. Multiple lawsuits won a portion of the money back for Enron stockholders. But the employees lost more than $2 billion in retirement funds. In the end, more than 20 top executives were found guilty for the crimes they committed while running the company. Enron became synonymous with the corporate greed that has been the hallmark of 21st century America. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Well, here's an interesting story. Sidney Powell, you may remember her name. She was one of Trump's lawyers. They're the ones who made up all these fanciful claims of election fraud and voter fraud and all of this stuff. Had some really great, had some great fables. Didn't bother to take many of them into the court of law, however. But evidently, the state of Michigan, evidently they're going to get a little money back. The state of Michigan and Detroit, I guess, went after the lawyer Sidney Powell and the rest of them. And this judge, the U.S. District Judge Linda Parker, she has ruled that Powell, Linwood, and others should be sanctioned and that they were going to have to pay $175,000 back to Michigan and the city of Detroit. Good for them. Now, every other place where they did their little song and dance and dog and pony show, maybe they should go after them and you know, dig into their pockets a little bit more for the nonsense that they pulled. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, the big one being the debt ceiling, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Sydney's in a couple other stories today, too.
Yeah, she's all over the place. Very popular.
This is the latest breaking news on Sidney Powell. And there's the disbarring for lying in court. That's a biggie. And then federal prosecutors are seeking records of fundraising groups that she launched. So,
well, I mean, that's what happens when you think that the former guy has your back.
Right. I mean, I think she will pay some kind of price, you know.
Yeah. I think Lynn Wood as well, and ultimately Rudy, too. I mean, at some point, you know, all of the dog and pony shows and all the things they did in court and around, at some point, it's got to come back to him.
I don't understand how he has escaped, you know, his work with the Ukraine, not filing as a foreign lobbyist. I mean, I don't get it.
Yeah, have you heard anything?
Escaped all that.
Have you heard anything about him lately?
Nothing. Zero, except when he was shaving at the airport at the lunch table.
Does that mean he's homeless? No, I'm not saying that. I don't think so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't heard, now that I think about it, I haven't heard anything from him. I guess he's been banned from Fox News, but he hasn't even been on the crazy stations.
Right.
Or the crazier stations.
Yeah, I just think he's laid low because, you know, even Rudy knows when he could be in trouble.
Yeah, well, at least I hope so. Interesting statement by Liz Cheney. She said that there's going to be, in the new year, there's being rapid progress being made, but in the new year, there are going to be multiple weeks of public hearings. They're going to set out for the American people, in her words, in vivid color, exactly what happened every minute of the day on January 6th at the Capitol and at the White House. And what led to the violent attacks in vivid color, Bob. We're going to see every bit of it.
Right. And she had said that. And then also she was warning of consequences for Trump in his dealings with the committee itself. And that, I think that was just yesterday she said something about that. You know, that he would be held responsible for any falsehood exchanged with the panel.
So do you think the Republicans are a little kind of regretting not putting people on the panel?
Well, it was a huge mistake. Look, I can remember a time, for example, when Cuba was the official host through the UN for a minority rights conference, right? And it was down in Africa, South Africa, I think. And we were sort of like boycotted, banned from going to it because Cuba was hosting it. I argued at that time with Sheila Jackson Lee. We both argued that, you know, there's no use to do these bans because, you know, Cuba hosted it. Well, this is the same type of thought. You know, fine, you know, Democrats constituted the committee, Republicans didn't like, so, you know, we're going to take our toys and go home. And that's not the way. If you're on the committee, you have a voice. Yeah. Sure, you can say things to the media, but if you're right there, it's the best thing, as you know, that can happen.
Yeah, it's crazy that they just kind of backed out of it, because now you're basically giving the other side the ability, whatever they want.
Exactly.
So the question that I have then is, is the calculus, they know that their supporters aren't going to listen to it anyway, have an alternative reality, and it's not going to hurt them politically. Do you think that's the calculus?
Well, I think so. I mean, look, the committee was constant. I mean, there's some downsides. Now, if Liz Cheney is correct, then there's going to be some upsides, but there's some downsides. It was constituted really late. Justice did finally, you know, step in and start to pursue people that weren't, you know, were thinking about not showing up, so they wouldn't. That helps for future witnesses. That gives it a little bit of life. But on the other hand, the Republicans were going to have this alternative, you know, constant alternative to it, and that never came about. So I just think it would have been better to have been on there, and then every step of the way they can, you know, they can argue.
Yeah. Now, they say that there are members of Congress that they're investigating as well. Are you surprised by that?
Well, nothing surprises me anymore. I guess what would surprise me is if members, it's just when I served there, it was different, but if members were, you know, giving information to people and it led towards, you know, having the ability to know about some of the, you know, places to go inside the building, then I just would be in total shock that somebody would do something so, you know, so treasonous.
Would you use that word? I mean, because some of the
yes,
some of the stories coming out is that there were members of Congress who gave tours. You know, you have James Clyburn who's saying, look, I've got an office that nobody should have been able to find, yet somehow they were able to find it. You know, if someone would have pointed that out, you're going to go that level?
Yes, I absolutely. If they participated in knowingly going beyond just, you know, some people wanted to come to the Capitol that happened to be in D.C. that day, and they went beyond that and told where the hideaways, Representative Clyburn is talking about the hideaways. I had one. Not many members have them. There's some, and they're basically secret places in the Capitol where that's why they're called hideaways. And they're, you know, private rooms that you have if you're in leadership or something of that nature, some of the people. And you can use them to, you know, go up to the floor, come back, do business, make phone calls, you know, those types of things. And if people found out where they are, those rooms, I don't want to go any farther with this because,
right,
you know, but if people found out where those rooms are, because you can't, if I took you in the Capitol, Rick, and I took you in hallways, and I said, tell me where the rooms are. You couldn't. You really couldn't.
No, look, I've gone through the Capitol, and I'm lost most of the time anyway.
No, right. So I think if they did directly say, hey, there's his office, and you're coming in the Capitol, I think it's treason, sure.
Yeah, and you got to wonder how they knew which, you know, which windows weren't, you know, weren't secure, and because they seemed to hit all the right places. Yeah. Also wanted to get your thoughts. It seems that the ticking bomb has been diffused, that we're not going to be shutting down the government this week, or at least that's what the report that I'm seeing right now. I don't know if the Senate has officially passed it yet, but that seems to be the reporting coming out.
Well, I think so. Look, you know, Trump said use this as leverage. Republicans were starting to say we're not going to do that. He became very unhappy, obviously. And if you look, if you really look at McConnell's history, he's not the, you know, stop the debt ceiling guy. You know, he did last time, then he provided 11 votes, you know, he played that game. But in general, I think he knew that, you know, he didn't want to play the game of chicken of who would, you know, would do this. Now, it's going to be temporary, but, you know, it still will serve the purpose to not have, you know, some bad things happen.
Yeah, get to the other side of Christmas is, because what I'm hearing,
right,
is the deal is sometime mid-February. But
exactly,
my problem again, and we've had this conversation 1,000 times, why do we even have this? It seems ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Well, it, you know, it was something, again, it's not constitutional. It's created by Congress. It could be uncreated by Congress. The hypocrisy of it, and you and I have said this 100 times, is that if you want to be fiscally prudent and a fiscal hawk, go through the budget process. This is after the horse is running down the path. This is paying for things already, voted upon. So it's not a fiscal responsible vote.
Yeah.
And we really particularly, honestly, don't need it.
But what it does is it shows how dysfunctional our government is. I mean,
sure.
I was thinking about this earlier. You know, the rest of the world is looking at us and going, is this the most powerful nation in the world? Is this the nation who should have the global currency, which, the vast majority of business on this planet is done in? Are these the people that should be running things? I got to tell you, if I'm looking in through the outside, I'm going, no.
And then the media, the media loves this whole, they're going to the edge, all the drama.
Yeah.
I'm looking like, okay, something's going to happen. Something will work out.
Now, did you need the 60 votes to pass this debt ceiling in the Senate?
Yes, they would have to have 60. Well, they can continue to try to put it into reconciliation, but they waste a vote if they do that. They can only do reconciliation on issues so many times.
Right.
So they're not going to do that. So remember, McConnell had to provide the 11 votes. Now, of course, they can do away with that. If they've got the votes, period, anyway.
Yeah, I don't think McConnell wants to.
Cloture's not constitutional.
Because that's how you stop things from happening.
Yeah, it'd be like tomorrow morning, to give this best example, of saying instead of 218 votes in the House, we now need 240, to bring a bill up. We just changed it. That's what the Senate did years ago.
Yeah. It's nuts, just nuts. Finally, I wanted to get your thoughts on the Supreme Court hearing yesterday and the fallout. Any additional thoughts on what we saw coming out of our Supreme Court?
Well, finally in June, they will, most likely do something. If they go with Mississippi, it looks like that may happen. I thought Kavanaugh made some, interesting comments originally. It would take the abortion issue and would allow states to do what Mississippi is doing and make it 15 weeks. Now, again, 90% of the abortions that occur are in 13 weeks. But, basically nobody wants to see, it go to 15, and maybe next time there's a state that takes the Supreme Court and it goes to 12. Who knows? But, again, it won't affect statistically 90%, but then there's the 10%, obviously, it does affect.
Yeah,
so I don't think it'll be a total reversal, but it's obviously going to have an impact.
Yeah, because I firmly, if this goes, I expect, very soon there to be another one to do what you said, keep whittling it down to eventually.
Right, exactly.
It's
right.
All gone, and then it goes back to the states. And,
yeah.
I've got some of my Democratic strategist friends going, this might not be a bad thing if that were to revert back to the states, because then you have you have something to get people riled up about. And I guess that's an interesting, kind of interesting way to look at it.
Well, it is. And Republicans, by the way, in the powers to be, are not real excited about this. They might be excited about the substance of the debate at the court, but they aren't excited, Rick, about this coming up now, because they want to keep it economy and immigration,
yep.
And, of course, the virus. They don't want this in June, maybe igniting the troops, should we say?
No, that's an excellent point. But here's the thing. The dog caught the car. This is something Republicans
exactly
have been pushing for a long time.
And caught the car in the wrong year. Right.
It'll be interesting to see if the dog gets run over.
It will.
It just is what it is. But, Bob, I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Always, great stuff.
Thank you.
Our good friend, Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman, political analyst. This is one of those moments. They caught the car for years. The Republicans have told us that they're going to do this. This is one of their key issues, and it may end up biting them in the behind next election year, because I don't expect this decision to come out until June, as the justices are leaving town, seeking cover. Because I think all to steal a Steve Bannon line, all what's going to break loose. because there are so many people who are sure that this wasn't going to happen. So many people sure that, you know, oh, you know, Susan Collins, you know, she looked into their soul and they weren't going to go after this. And you go, of course they were. It was one of the things that the Federalist Society made sure that they were right on, along with all of the business stuff. And I always go back to, you know, Tom DeLay, you know, did this little spiel about, you know, if we had all the kids that were aborted, you know, we could have all of those cheap laborers. You know, ultimately that's what's in their mind. We can have all these poor kids born because we can put them to work doing cheap work and ultimately drop the bottom out of the economy. That's really what they're about. This whole pro-life nonsense, I'm not buying it for a minute. Because if they were truly pro-life, their policies would show that in every other way possible. Their budgets would show that. But it doesn't. What we see more corporate greed. We see more handouts to the very wealthy and more demonizing of the poor and the downtrodden. Exactly everything opposite of what we're told the Christian nation should be going after. Just my thought, just my opinion. But it's what we're seeing coming out of them. Now for me, I'm gonna be glued to whatever happens in the new year on these hearings, because it's my view this should have been happening already. We should have had, you know, perp walks already. We should have had people with nice brand new shiny bracelets, you know, and nice orange outfits for their new domicile. If Liz Cheney's right, and they do lay this out in vivid color, to use her words, exactly what happens every minute of every day, the question then comes back to, will it matter? Will it move the needle? Will the ardent Trump supporter find an epiphany? Will there be a moment where they go, that's too far? I don't know. I have hope. Not the kind of hope that makes me irrationally hopeful, but I do have a little hope that maybe we can find that common ground that we used to have. We weren't all singing Kumbaya together. There were fights, but we were more in the middle of the road than not. Because here's the sad reality. While we're involved in this kind of this bickering, this fighting, this tearing each other apart, there are kids going to bed hungry. There are veterans going to bed homeless. There are families that are struggling. And for me, every day we don't get something done to make people's lives better is a wasted day. And today in Congress, you look at the fact that they're fighting over this debt ceiling. Sorry, it's a wasted day. We should have been doing something. And they weren't. And one side of the political aisle is happy with that. Because they don't believe in government. They don't believe government can help or should help. The weird thing is I still know some Republicans who don't feel that way, who think like I do, that government does what we cannot do individually, gives us the opportunity to collectively get things done. And we all want the same things, I think. I do. I still believe that. We're like, good, safe neighborhoods for our kids. We want opportunities for them. We want health care. We want retirement security. We want good paying jobs. Those are the things we should be focusing on. And anyone who's just looking for attention, i.e. Lauren Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Gates, Gohmert, the rest of them, we got to set aside. Got to let it go. It's kind of where I've gone with the anti-vax people. Got to let them go. We spend too much time protecting people from themselves. You don't want to get vaccinated, don't. But what's going to happen to you, that's on you. Just for me, that simple. And it doesn't get any simpler than that, because they're clearly not going to listen. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Follow us on social media, on Twitter @RickSmithShow. We do the Facebook thing as you want to throw a message there. Follow us on YouTube, subscribe, share all of that, all good stuff. I appreciate you being here. Thanks so much. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.